Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're going to be talking about efforts by the Israeli government to crack down on BDS, as well as some of what's going on with the death penalty, among other things. But before we can move on. The murder of mother Charlena Lyles has been roiling Seattle for a few weeks now as issues of policing there take center stage after her death. As many listeners of this show may remember, in 2012, Seattle signed a consent decree with the Justice Department after an investigation that found, as these things always do, widespread constitutional violations and serious issues with the police use of force. The report had found at that time that 25% of the time use of force by Seattle police was unconstitutional. That's a quarter. It also noted, quote, SPD officers escalate situations and use unnecessary or excessive force when arresting individuals for minor offenses. This trend is pronounced in encounters with persons with mental illnesses or those under the influence of alcohol or drugs. This is problematic because SPD estimates that 70% of use of force encounters involve these populations. And the fact that Ms. Lyles' killing, according to family members, she may have been having a mental health episode, represented a continuation of some of these policies has raised serious questions of whether or not the consent decree was working. And today, a federal judge is holding a status hearing on the consent decree to discuss many of these issues, undoubtedly. Mayor Ed Murray, who's under quite a cloud around sexual abuse allegations himself, unilaterally decided yesterday to issue an executive order requiring the implementation of police body cameras immediately across the city. The fact that Lyles' death was not caught on camera has raised some hackles as the mayor and the police union have been locked in contentious negotiations over the rollout. As you might expect, the police union very upset, claiming Murray's jumping the line on this one and that somehow body cameras will be worse for them, but too late now, as Seattle is joining Washington, D.C., Denver, Colorado, and Oakland, California in a full rollout of body cameras to all officers. A community survey from 2016 showed 86% of people in Seattle wanted the cops to wear body cameras, so the policy has wide support from the public as well. The city is also locked into broader contract battles with the police union that's creeping into local politics. In particular, former Washington Tenants Union head city council candidate John Grant is making a strong push on more transparency in union negotiations as well as more independent oversight, things that police firmly resist. And mayoral candidate Nikita Oliver, who's the candidate who's really coming from the grassroots social movements, including the Movement for Black Lives, has made inroads with voters by raising a lot of these same issues recently. It seems very likely then that the police and the politicians in Seattle might be fairly at odds moving forward here. Also of note, the Seattle City Council unanimously passed the quote-unquote bias-free policing policy yesterday that it was mandated by the consent decree, allegedly taking a step forward in reducing bias in policing. Either way, it's clear that the murder by Seattle cops of Charlena Lyles has injected a new urgency into the discussion in the Puget Sound area about consent decrees, policing practices, and so on. And what happens there will have important implications for cities around the nation. We've noted many times when we discuss Attorney General Jeff Sessions that he is Mr. Law and Order Policing. Sessions is far outside of the mainstream on these issues. He even clashed with almost all the other hard right Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee over basic common sense reforms to things like mandatory minimums. Sessions isn't a conservative when it comes to criminal justice. He's pro-police. Those two things can go together, but they don't have to. Clearly, over the past several years, there's been a rise in conservative criticism of the vast powers of police and the intense abuses that accompany that power, alongside dissatisfaction with the state of our system of mass incarceration. Sessions is a different animal, one who agrees with career prosecutors and cops on everything. No matter how much evidence there is, a particular pet policy or procedure does not work, Sessions will defend it if cops still like it. What this really boils down to is that Sessions is the key defender of the ability of the police to wantonly violate your constitutional rights without oversight or sanction. And he has proven that yet again. Yesterday, promising to increase civil asset forfeiture. This is extraordinarily controversial as this is a practice that many conservatives also revile. Why? Well, civil asset forfeiture is when cops take your stuff or money in your bank account and then use it to fund their own operations. Now, the way they present it is, well, criminals shouldn't keep the proceeds of their crime. But here's the kicker. You don't have to be convicted to have your stuff taken. And in some cases, you don't even need to be criminally charged. As the Washington Post notes, since 2007, the Drug Enforcement Administration alone has taken more than $3 billion in cash from people not charged with any crime, according to the Justice Department's Inspector General. The federal standard for asset forfeiture is terrible. In fact, the Institute for Justice that studies these things gave the feds a D-. All the feds have to prove is that there is a preponderance of evidence that this is the proceeds of a crime and 100% of the funds will go back to their own pockets. Even worse, if you get your stuff taken by the feds, the burden is on you to prove it's not proceeds of a crime. So say that your cousin deals drugs. You go over to their house to, say, play some video games or something. Whatever, it's your cousin. You're hanging out. You don't know the house is under surveillance. You come over in your brand new, very expensive car. Wouldn't take much for the DEA if they wanted to say, well, this person's there 3 times a week. They have a car that they probably couldn't afford, so on and so forth. They seize the car. Now, you know that you just got a little cash windfall. That's how you got the car. But now you've got to prove it while your stuff was taken and cashed in by the DEA for their own purposes. And that is what Sessions wants to increase. The tales of abuse here are a mile long. The Post names a few, such as, quote, one case in 2016 when Oklahoma police seized $53,000 owned by a Christian band, an orphanage, and a church after stopping a man on a highway for a broken taillight. A few years earlier, a Michigan drug task force raided the home of a self-described soccer mom, suspecting she was not in compliance with the state's medical marijuana law. They proceeded to take every belonging from the family, including tools, a bicycle, and her daughter's birthday money. And, of course, this is so bad, states are starting to clamp down. 13 states have laws that say you can only seize in the case of a criminal conviction. Now, listeners of this show may also remember that we reported on a bill introduced into the very conservative Texas state legislature by a very conservative lawmaker designed to do just that earlier this year. Even the Heritage Foundation, the most iconic right-wing think tank, has critiqued civil asset forfeiture and even has a very critical FAQ about it up on their website. Sessions, however, wants to push forward a practice of something called adoptive forfeitures, where state and local cops can work with the feds to share some of the proceeds, but more importantly, it allows them to circumvent the tougher laws at the state and local level. So in other words, Sessions wants to overrule the democratic process to arbitrarily and administratively allow the police to seize the belongings of people who may not even be charged with a crime. Jeff Sessions is emerging as exactly the person everyone thought he was. Essentially, he is the worst cop in every department, or at the least, the guy who covers for that cop, except he's also the nation's top law enforcement official. Well, on a slightly more lighthearted note, security guards who are out there listening, you don't need to worry about robots taking over your job. There's a company out there, Nightscope. They created this K-5 security robot that was supposed to help replace the mall cops of the world. K-5 recently deployed to an office building here in D.C., and it then subsequently fell into a fountain and drowned. Yes, it no longer works, and had to be rescued by, you guessed it, humans. Obviously, the robot takeover, not quite here yet. And finally, and much more seriously, Planned Parenthood is challenging Iowa's abortion waiting period law in a case that could have major implications around the country. 27 states currently have some sort of waiting period between abortion counseling and actually having an abortion, and Iowa is one of the most draconian, one of 6 states with a 3-day waiting period. These laws are part of the broader attempt to raise the cost, both monetary and personal, of abortions to try to create what amounts to a backdoor ban on abortions. Anti-abortion forces have taken to trying to institute at the state level a number of restrictive laws designed to get around the fact that abortions are still legal. These waiting periods can cause serious issues in rural states or states that have a lot of rural areas like Iowa, where there are very few abortion clinics available. So a woman must travel to a city or somewhere else, find a place to stay, and so on, not to mention the issue of their job, getting days off and the like, and then harmonizing that with the hours of the clinic. And also you can add childcare to that mix as well if the woman already has children. So Planned Parenthood and the ACLU are suing, saying that this Iowa law places an undue burden on women. This was the basis on which the Supreme Court struck down provisions in the Texas abortion law, in particular the requirement that physicians maintain the admitting privileges with the local hospital, that the clinics meet the same standards as basically emergency rooms. Win in this case would certainly put those six states then with the three-day waiting periods in the crosshairs in need of new laws, but it could perhaps strike down or at least create the basis to strike down the issue of these waiting periods overall, which would have major reverberations and would be a significant win in the fight for women to have access to reproductive health care. So without a doubt, this is a case to watch. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we switch gears a little bit. Well, by Brad Friedman. He's a blogger. Ooh, I'm struggling a little bit today at bradblog.com. He's a journalist, actor, and host of The Bradcast, also here on Radio Sputnik. Brad, thank you so much for joining us.
Always my pleasure, Eugene.
So I just want to start here. Robbie Mook, people remember him. He was the campaign manager of Hillary Clinton's campaign. Some dude who worked with Romney in 2012. I mean, super random, but they are now heading up a new project at Harvard Kennedy School called Defending Digital Democracy, which is allegedly supposed to secure America against all evil persons who want to manipulate the U.S. election process, and their words, in the same way that Russia did this time around. Your thoughts on this new venture?
Well, it's not some random person from Romney's campaign. It's actually the guy who headed Romney's campaign. And so in that you have this bipartisan commission that they are putting themselves together in order to try to improve concerns about security with our voting system. In truth, I'm fine with that. I think that's a good idea. I think that makes a hell of a lot more sense than the non-bipartisan committee, the nonsense committee, the sham committee that Trump has put together, which is really just a scheme to institute voter suppression rules and restrictions around the country. That said, I am always dubious. I am always skeptical when I see folks talking about election security, because they tend to focus on computerized solutions to our problems rather than, you know, public oversight of our problems, which that is really the solution. If you're concerned about hacking of our electoral systems, well, if you have hand-marked paper ballots that are counted by human beings at the precinct on election night before the ballots are moved anywhere, you've got a fully robust, transparent, overseeable electoral system, and that's important. That's what we need. They're talking about computer solutions, it seems, and trying to protect against various threats. You mentioned Russia, but, you know, the fact is, yes, as I have been warning for about 15 years, people wish to game our electoral system, and it doesn't need Russia to do it. You know, some guy sitting in Dallas has as much of an interest in gaming our system and gaming any electoral system anywhere. So, yeah, you need to protect against that, but you don't protect against it. Security by obscurity has sort of been the method we've used by trying to keep everything secret. As people are beginning to realize, that is not going to work. I don't mind at all this type of commission. I wish they were more focused on getting rid of the crappy election machines that we use. And as far as I can tell from the people who have been named to the committee, I don't see any voting systems experts. I see cybersecurity experts, but not voting systems experts. So they may be people who don't understand the real threats that we face to our elections.
Yeah, I think that's actually – I think that's 100% correct, and it's saying one of the main things that they're sort of looking to do, as you mentioned, is sort of deal with this issue of quote-unquote weaponization of information, which I to me also raises something of sort of a scary issue there too, though, because, you know, many things that were circulated during the election, amplified by bots, whatever they may have been, you know, some of it was fake, like the Hillary Clinton health stuff. Some of it was true, like amplifying things in the WikiLeaks. And does there become sort of a – I was concerned about this in the campaign with the sort of fake news issue. Does it sort of almost become an issue where censorship of like what's acceptable and what's unacceptable in the political discourse also becomes a factor, as opposed to what I think the real issue people are concerned about is, which is election security? It seems like the two things are being conflated when they maybe should be dealt with a little separately.
Yeah, they are absolutely being conflated, and they're using this idea of information warfare, the weaponization of those DNC emails and Hillary Clinton emails. That seems to me to be an extraordinarily vague thing to try to deal with and to even try to measure. I mean, the notion that they're saying that the release of these emails somehow resulted in exactly the right number of votes and exactly just the places that they need. And remember, in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania had 3 votes in each precinct been recorded for Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump, she would be the president, not he. So you're talking about an incredibly small number of votes that they were hoping would be influenced by this so-called weaponization of information. I guess maybe that could have happened. I don't know. We don't have any real good evidence to support it other than the claims by the intelligence community, but we don't actually have a lot of firsthand evidence. If somebody, whoever, wanted to game the election, to steal the election, the easiest way by far, is just go in and through all sorts of various means to do this, to go into to either the voting machines themselves or more directly the central tabulators. And in seconds time, you can change the results and nobody will ever know, because those same people, including those Democrats who are concerned about the results, never bothered to check the actual voting systems. And the DHS has now admitted that. The Democrats decided not to hand count the ballots that relied on Jill Stein to try and do, and she was blocked from doing so by and large. So it does make you question the whole enterprise, in truth. But you know what? More people looking at stuff, in my opinion, is almost always better, so long as it's not meant to curb our civil rights, whether they're voting rights, whether they're First Amendment rights. I can't even imagine how they would curb those First Amendment rights with this the commission you're talking about, but that's why we everything needs to be in public so we can oversee it.
Mm-hmm. Couple minutes left here. One thing that didn't get a lot of real coverage, but I think is interesting, I'm curious your takes on it. The Election Assistance Commission, which could be defunded, I think, by the end of 2018 if there's not any intervention here by Congress. Your thoughts, good, bad, indifferent?
Complicated question to answer in a very short time. I will say this, the Elections Assistance Commission over the years has been wildly corrupt and unbelievably ineffective. That said, we need the Elections Assistance Commission. We need one that actually works. We don't need to defund it. We need to fund it, properly fund it. And, I remember interviewing years ago the very first commissioner, the chief of the commission years ago, was appointed by George W. Bush, and he eventually quit because he believed that neither Congress nor the White House were taking the EAC seriously. And at that time, he warned that our elections were rife for being stolen, and that something needed to be done about it. Well, nobody has listened very closely to what he had to say years ago. We need to start doing that. We don't need to get rid of the commission, as Republicans are trying to do, especially now. We need to improve the commission so we have any type of national oversight of our terrible electronic voting systems, at least as long as we're going to continue using them.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. And I know for our listeners who are looking maybe to track this down, Mike Quigley from Illinois has actually introduced a bill to refund it. So that might be a way you can track it down. Either way, Brad Friedman, thank you so much. Host of the Bradcast, which is here on Radio Sputnik. Also a blogger at bradblog.com. So lots on this and many other very interesting things. So definitely check him out on both of those platforms. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the continued, some new, some not that new, but new to this show, developments as it relates to death penalty in America. And we are very happy to be joined for this segment by Mr. Robert Dunham, who's the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Mr. Dunham, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me back.
So I wanted to start here with a report that I felt at least was shocking in many ways from the Fair Punishment Project. It's based at Harvard. The title of the report, for people who want to look it up online, The Recidivist, Four Prosecutors Who Repeatedly Violate the Constitution. And basically the story here is that a handful of offices seem to just disproportionately be involved in misconduct when it comes to the death penalty. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this study and what it reflects.
Well, I think that the study is just the tip of the iceberg. Mm. When we look at the causes of wrongful capital convictions, and we've looked at the data for all of the cases of death penalty exonerations over the last decade, the single most likely factor, the single most prevalent cause of wrongful capital convictions is official misconduct. Mm. So the question of prosecutors and police withholding evidence or engaging in other improper conduct in capital cases is nothing new. And the Fair Punishment Project report illustrates one of the phenomena that we've been observing, which is that the death penalty is overproduced in a very small number of counties. Rephrased, 2% of America's counties produce more than 55% of all the death sentences. So the death penalty is narrowly used in the United States. And one of the characteristics of the counties that overuse the death penalty is prosecutorial misconduct. Mm. And it makes sense because you don't overuse the death penalty. You're not overly aggressive in trying to take somebody's life while you're being fair doing everything else. Mm. Reports like this from the Fair Punishment Project illustrate that there are systemic concerns about improprieties in the administration of criminal justice in counties that overpursue the death penalty. And let's look at the counties who are involved here. Mm-hmm. Orange County in California. Orange County ranks among the top 99.5% of all counties in the United States in imposing death sentences. Mm. It ranked number 7 among all the counties in 2013. And since that time, it's been also in the top 0.5% in producing new death sentences.
Wow.
What else is going on there? There are scandals with the crime lab. There's an ongoing scandal with the sheriff's office placing informants next to the cells of targeted defendants, trying to elicit confessions out of them after those defendants have been represented by counsel. So it's a clear violation of their Sixth Amendment right to counsel and Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. That's been going on for decades, and the county is continuing to deny that it's doing anything wrong. St. Louis City, one of the four counties mentioned here, ranked in the top 10 in the number of executions between 1976 and 2013. Orleans Parish has almost a cottage industry in withholding critical information in death penalty cases. There have been three separate death penalty cases coming out of Orleans County that have made it up to the United States Supreme Court that have involved a pattern and practice of deliberately withholding exculpatory information in capital cases. And Shelby, Memphis, Tennessee. There are ongoing scandals about prosecutors withholding information in capital cases. So these have been known to be problem counties. These are recidivist counties, as the Fair Punishment Project says. But what it illustrates are two major concerns. Prosecutorial misconduct is a serious concern in capital cases across the country, and it is more likely to occur and recur in counties that disproportionately seek the death penalty.
Well, I think that's very interesting. And it leads me to a sort of another more philosophical question. And I think because I think most people are maybe not aware of how few counties are responsible for so many death sentences, that there's sort of an ideological political element in the death penalty as well, where it's sort of this crime deserves this punishment, not necessarily because of any evidence or whatever, but because this is what we as a community, whatever. I think you see where I'm going with this.
I think that the death penalty is driven by personality more than almost anything else. Mm. the single most important factor in determining whether someone is capitally prosecuted isn't what they did. It's where they did it. It is who is the prosecutor at that time and what is their political orientation when it comes to the death penalty. It isn't a question of Democrat or Republican. It's a question of do they perceive that there is a political benefit to them for pursuing the death penalty. Mm-hmm. When we look at the 2% counties that have had significant fall off in the number of cases in which they seek the death penalty, we haven't seen changes in the crime rates. What we've seen is change in who the prosecutors are. So you bring in a new prosecutor who's a reform prosecutor, death sentences tend to drop. Mm. And voters have, in many of these counties, said enough is enough. In the last 2 years, 2015, 2016, elections in Caddo Parish, Shreveport, Louisiana, elections in Birmingham, Alabama, in Tampa.
Right.
There have been reform prosecutors who opposed, in Jacksonville as well, who opposed incumbents who were perceived as overusing the death penalty, and they won. Mm. And in Philadelphia, in this spring, the primary election, Lawrence Krasner was nominated as the Democratic nominee for district attorney on a platform that he is going to not use the death penalty at all. Mm. So we're seeing that the biggest reform in death penalty practices is actually the election of reform prosecutors who want to change the criminal justice system as a whole to make it fairer. The death penalty is driven by personality, and reforms may also be driven by personality.
Mm. Well, and I'm glad you raised that issue too, and that the issue of Florida came up, because one thing that just popped in my mind, Aramis Ayala, one of these state's attorneys in Florida, I think she was the first black – I forget if they're state's attorneys.
That's right.
Commonwealth attorney here in my Virginia mind. Strong, I'm not going to seek the death penalty. The governor has then, I know, been trying to remove her authority. Is that still ongoing? I mean, she made news also for being pulled over in a driving while black situation. So what's the update there?
The update is that Governor Scott decided that he was going to remove her from 24 homicide cases in which the death penalty could be sought. After she said that she would not pursue it as a matter of public policy. It's not the only time in U.S. history that's happened, but there's some striking parallels between what happened with George Pataki in New York in 1996 and Rick Scott here in 2017. When George Pataki removed Robert Johnson, it was a Republican, a white male Republican, removing the only elected black state district attorney in the state. Here, it's a white male Republican removing the only black elected state attorney in Florida, both for refusing initially to pursue the death penalty for the killing of a police officer. Well, Aramis Ayala said, look, I am locally elected to exercise my discretion. It's not that I've chosen not to prosecute murders. I'm prosecuting murders, but I've chosen to prosecute murders and seek a sentence of life without possibility of parole. That is my legal – I have the legal authority to do that. It is my discretion. And so she has gone to court, and there was argument in the Florida Supreme Court just a couple weeks ago on this, and we're expecting a decision in a month or so. But it could have significant implications. You know, when we're looking at the exercise of discretion, Governor Scott has not – attempted to replace the district attorney, the state attorney in Miami-Dade, when she refused to seek any charges at all against the prison guards who had scalded a mentally ill inmate to death. So if you're talking about using it to correct failures to exercise discretion properly, it's already objectively unreasonable. Mm. But the real question is, are governors supposed to – is it good policy and is it lawful for them to substitute their discretion for that of a local official who is elected precisely to exercise her discretion?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's 100% true. And I mean, it also feels to me a little bit like Rick Scott is trying to hold the line against shifting public opinion in his own state. I mean, of course, Ms. Ayala's elected to her position there on this, making a big deal out of the death penalty. You had the Supreme Court there rule the jury unanimity that to impose the death penalty. And now I believe that their death row population is the lowest it's been in some time now. I mean, it seems like on the ground in Florida, the facts are shifting and Rick Scott is sort of, you know, trying to put his finger on the dike here to prevent a significant change in how the death penalty is administered in his state.
I think it's certainly true, and we've seen in a number of different states that as support for the death penalty has crumbled and as nationwide patterns suggest that the public is moving away from it, you have almost acts of desperation by death penalty proponents to try to prop up the system. And that's why I think we're seeing in some of the more conservative legislatures bills that would make it easier to execute people not by fixing what's wrong with the death penalty system, but by limiting access to courts for the defendants. Mm. And that's the kind of Proposition 66 bill in California, that referendum that would limit the appeals. There was some discussion in Louisiana when the bill to abolish the death penalty came surprisingly close to emerging from a House committee. It lost by a vote of 9-8. But one of the legislators who opposed the efforts to eliminate the death penalty said, you know, we've seen a lot of problems, and one of the problems is we can't execute people. Let's try to figure out a way to speed things up. Mm. So you see these almost anti-democratic policies being espoused when the proponents of the death penalty begin to get frustrated that they haven't been able to execute people.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a good point, and I want to sort of switch gears on that point to some of the Supreme Court stuff we saw in this term. One specific case that we did talk about on the show that I want to get your thoughts on since we talked to our listeners about it was Davila v. Davis, which if people remember, that was the case we discussed on here, that it's very complicated in many ways, but essentially saying that this an execution could not be stopped because this gentleman who was saying that at previous levels of the appeals process, his attorney was not competent, and thus the crucial issue that could have led to him going free was never raised. They're basically saying, well, look, it's not our fault. It didn't get raised a long time ago, and you don't have the ability now to just like come from behind and look at it. Now, I've seen some people say this is not like a death penalty case because obviously those issues have broader provenance, but I'm just sort of curious, you know, what you think about this ruling in this case. I mean, it seemed to me somewhat egregious that, like, yes, we recognize you had ineffective counsel, but no, we're going to let you be killed because it's a procedural question.
The real question boiled down to its essence is what happens if a state provides you ineffective representation at multiple layers of your case? Mm. And the outcome in this case says that we will reward the state if they succeed in providing a capital defendant ineffective representation at certain key stages. Mm. There is a rule, generally speaking, that in habeas corpus, which most people think of as a federal appeal of your state criminal conviction, but it isn't really an appeal. An appeal would mean that you get to raise your issues and the judge will decide them on the merits. Federal habeas corpus is a procedure in which you get to challenge your conviction, but there are certain rules. Mm. And the rules are one of the key rules is you're supposed to have presented your claim to the state courts first. Well, if the state court provides you ineffective representation, and remember, in capital cases, virtually everybody is indigent. Mm. So they're not represented by hired lawyers who have tons of resources to investigate their cases. They're represented by whoever the state provides. Mm. And oftentimes, what's provided is incompetent representation, bad lawyers with no resources. Now, the Supreme Court has said if you get a bad lawyer with no resources at trial, and because of that you don't raise an issue, you can challenge that lawyer's effectiveness. Mm. If you get ineffective representation at trial and your post-conviction lawyer, the lawyer who is charged with bringing up claims of new evidence, also fails to raise the issue because of ineffectiveness, then we will let you raise that issue in federal court. We will say that the post-conviction lawyer's incompetence was cause that excuses the procedural default created by the failure to raise the issue. Mm. Well, what happens if you have quality representation or just competent representation at trial and the trial lawyer raises a meritorious issue and the trial court gets it wrong. The issue's preserved, and so it's the kind of record-based issue that your appellate lawyer is supposed to raise. What if your appellate lawyer blows it and fails to raise that issue, and then your post-conviction lawyer doesn't raise the issue? That's the difference between the first scenario I told you, you know, we just talked about, where trial lawyer blows it and then post-conviction lawyer blows it. Then you're allowed to raise the issue in habeas corpus. Davila presented the case where the trial lawyer didn't blow it, but the appeals lawyer did, and then the post-conviction lawyer did. Why should that be treated any differently? And that's what the dissenters say. There is no principal distinction between a case where the trial lawyer blows it and the appeals lawyer blows it, and then you're provided inadequate representation by the state in the post-conviction stage. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court majority says no. There's something special about protecting the right to trial counsel, and it's different from the appellate counsel right. I don't see the distinction. I don't see the distinction. In fact, in many senses, it's worse, because here the appellate counsel's failure to raise an issue that trial counsel preserved completely undermines the right to trial counsel.
Right. No, I think it's a good point. And in fact, it was one that was abstracted out of an article as a non-specific death penalty case. Stephen McAllister, he's the Solicitor General of Kansas, basically the top lawyer of Kansas for people who are listening. He had an interesting piece on SCOTUS blog, a court increasingly uncomfortable with the death penalty. That's what he took from the sort of death penalty related cases this term. I know you watch these things very closely. Do you think that's a fair statement or maybe a slight overdraw?
I think that the court has been uncomfortable with the death penalty for a long time. The real question is, what are they going to do about it? And the way in which the court has handled it year after year now is it doesn't tackle the big question. So is the court so uncomfortable with the death penalty that it will grant review to challenge the constitutionality of the practice itself? Or is it uncomfortable with the death penalty and wants to tinker around the edges? I think what we've seen over the last decade is the court is tinkering around the edges. And when you look at the patterns in these cases, there are similarities. Last time I was on, we talked about Bobby Joe Moore's case in which Texas had invented some non-scientific standards to determine whether somebody had intellectual disability. Well, Texas was an outlier. Nobody else engaged in practices like that. It was so extreme that the Supreme Court, uncomfortable with some aspects of the death penalty, wasn't willing to allow somebody to be executed based upon completely made-up standards for whether they had intellectual disability. Dwayne Buck, it was another outlier. It was such an extreme case where his own lawyer presented evidence from a mental health expert that he would be a danger in the future because he was black. Right. These are cases that we're seeing the Supreme Court responding to practices that are just so far out of the mainstream that they feel it's necessary to address them. Is it a court that's increasingly uncomfortable with the death penalty? I think it's a court that's uncomfortable with the death penalty, and it's responding to extreme practices. Those are the ones it's been correcting.
I mean, it really seems the person who's got the biggest sort of burr in the saddle on this is Sonia Sotomayor, who's putting out a lot of these has put out a number of dissents, it seems, on that. And she seems to want to sort of drive this as well as other criminal justice reforms. About a minute left. I mean, does it work like that? I mean, I don't even know how the court works. I mean, can some one person interview someone who feels ideologically – you know, whatever about what the whether or not there should be a death penalty. I'm sorry, about a minute for that broad question.
Well, I think that that Justice Sotomayor is very concerned with criminal justice in general and fairness in general, and she has been quick to point out that the facts don't tend to support a number of the cases in which the death sentences have been upheld. She's been concerned about the courts allowing executions with the drug midazolam, for example, where the clear scientific evidence shows that it is incapable of rendering the person unconscious and keeping them unconscious while they are being killed by other drugs that administered by themselves would unquestionably cause extraordinary pain. And so she has kind of insisted in her opinions on looking at what the facts really are. One of the things we saw with President Obama's judicial appointments were that you ended up with a much more diverse court that had many, many more practical experiences. Mm. She is the voice of practical experience on the court.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great place for us to leave it. Robert Dunham, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center, deathpenaltyinfo.org, if you want to learn more. We're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are, well, continuing, I would say, a topic that we've talked about quite a bit here in this show, which is the Israel-Palestine conflict, the occupation, and so on. And we are very happy to be joined again here on By Any Means Necessary by Ariel Gold with Code Pink. Ariel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. I am currently on the ground in Hebron, the most heavily occupied city in the West Bank.
Mm, and you are in Hebron, I should say. I believe you have been working to monitor the trial of Issa Amro. Is that correct?
I have been. He had the first court date of his trial last Sunday.
Mm. And just to revive people's memory here who may not have heard our last segment, Issa is sort of the Palestinian Gandhi, I believe some people call him.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's this famous quote that was said by an Israeli official, which was, "We don't do Gandhi well." And for this reason, they're really trying to put Issa away. So when I went to the first date of the trial, first two witnesses testified against him. It was a soldier and the soldier's commander. And the judge was part of the military, as was the prosecutor. And the first witness, the soldier, was as he left the room, was making familial gestures with the judge, kind of this "see you later, maybe at dinner" type of relationship between them. There were a lot of inconsistencies with the testimony that was given. They both conflicted with each other, the two witnesses, as well as with the statements they had made at the time of this particular arrest of Issa's. However, none of this really has any bearing on whether Issa will be convicted, because the Israeli military court has an over 99% conviction rate. And this is just a situation of straightforward apartheid here, where there are two separate laws for two groups of people. In Hebron, where I am right now, working on a daily basis with Issa and staying at the activist center that he runs here, there is a road, one of the main roads in Hebron, and the road is divided by a fence that goes down it, with two-thirds of the road for Jews and one-third of the road, in which it is the pavement is broken and uneven, for Muslims. And when you come to the beginning of the road, they ask you your religion. And based on your answer, you're either allowed to pass on the nice, wide, paved Jewish side, or you're sent over to the Palestinian side. And they've now taken this a step further and expanded the fence so that the entire neighborhood alongside it is enclosed, basically imprisoned. There's a door to enter inside that area, which is how you enter that road. And a buzzer goes off every time that door is opened. It's like a fence door. And the door is locked from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. every day.
Well, it's been interesting to hear about this case, and you've done quite a bit to spotlight it, had quite a bit of success, I think, gotten a congressional letter with a number of signers. And I don't know, perhaps I would say these two things seem to be connected. You also have been the target of a lot of attacks directed at you by some people who haven't been that happy with your activism while both there and in the United States. Talk a little bit about that, if you will. I believe even Sheldon Adelson's newspaper sort of getting in on this as well.
Absolutely. Sheldon Adelson's paper did get in on this. So about a week after I arrived, and I'm not quite sure what initiated this. It could have been a number of things, including the really vile settlers that are here in Hebron. Israel Hayom, which is the largest newspaper in Israel, which is Sheldon Adelson's paper and is also Netanyahu's paper, published an attack on me on the front page, basically saying that I had entered Israel under false pretenses and that because I support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the new law that Israel applied, which is a law banning activists, should apply to me, and that calling for me to be deported and attacking my character. And it stated in there that Israel's Minister of Internal Security had been contacted, and he replied that I was being investigated. And it was uncertain at that time whether I would be actively deported from the country while here or if they would deny reentry to me later. I do sense know that I won't be deported while here. And I think part of that is due to Haaretz, which is the liberal newspaper here, picking up the story and doing both a written piece on my situation as well as video yesterday. And people can find that online on Haaretz.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really was unbelievable to read some of the stuff. I mean, even, you know, basically making it seem as if it was criminal to hide your Facebook for friends only as opposed to public, which is something that people do all the time and switch back and forth actually all the time, depending on what's happening in their lives. So, I mean, it was really, in some ways, unbelievably petty, but it also seems that to some degree, for those who support the occupation policies, in some way, it's very important to them to silence voices like yours because they can't be easily dismissed as, you know, quote unquote, anti-Semitic or whatever it may be.
Absolutely. And so I want to give an example of what happened yesterday to me, which is what let me know that, in fact, I won't be actively deported during the time I'm here. So I was visiting with two young Israeli women who had both refused to serve in the military here. And we were walking in Hebron, and I mistakenly, we walked from the Jewish area of Hebron, which are basic, almost entirely Jewish only streets, to the Palestinian area of Hebron. And no sooner did we get over there that I realized, oh no, Israeli citizens are forbidden by law from being in the Palestinian section because Israel is very intent on keeping these two populations separate and making sure that Palestinians don't have solidarity from their counterparts in Israel that don't support the apartheid regime. So we got over there and I had called some friends and we kind of came up with the, you know, how to get back over to the side where they were allowed to be. And we did accomplish that. And we sat down to have some coffee and talk about each of our stories. And this really vile settler that lives here in Hebron recognized me and came over to harass me. And he's quite, it's quite disgusting the things that come out of his mouth when he starts harassing me. And the soldiers are here to protect him. He recognized that the two girls with me were Israeli and assumed that we had been in the Palestinian side. And he demanded of the Israeli soldiers that they arrest the three of us. And the reality here is that when settlers demand that somebody be arrested, the soldiers most of the time comply. And in this case, they did comply. We were detained, forced to stand in the very hot heat, like directly in the sun with no shade, for a few hours outside the police station in Hebron while deciding what to do with us. And one of the women that I was with is mobility impaired, and she was received no accommodations. And so after all this time, they did decide to arrest the two women. And I think at this point, they were still planning on arresting me, though I actually hadn't violated any laws at all. Because as a tourist, as an American citizen, I am allowed on both sides. So I got taken to the police station, the three of us did, where we were harassed for a while longer. The two Israeli women were interrogated. And then I was basically shoved out the back gate of the police station and told to leave. And this is a really common occurrence here, you know, usually for Palestinians, that you just get dragged up to the police station. Half your day is gone. You maybe get charged. You maybe don't. and often on the demands of a settler.
And I mean, the fact that, I mean, all of this could add up to you potentially being barred from the country and coming back. I mean, how does it make you feel? I mean, to, I don't know, to even to have this be happening to you.
Well, I'm really heartbroken about that. And yet at the same time, I recognize all of the Palestinian refugees around the world who still don't have the right to return to their homelands. Palestinian refugees in refugee camps like Aida Camp in Bethlehem, who can't return to their homes still since 1948. And I receive a lot of privilege as a Jewish American. It will be something that I can test if I'm not allowed back in. I do come here to do activist work and to stand in solidarity with my partners here, Palestinian organizations and individuals that devote their lives to this struggle.
You know, I mean, I always wonder in situations like this, if to some degree when it seems, and I think, you know, when you sort of read it and it just seems, I think, absurd for many people that they would have maybe even be going to this lengths, if that in a sign is a way, is a reflection of how effective some of these things are starting to become, whether it be BDS or, I mean, for example, even just the letter that you did in Congress there or were a key part of around Issa's case, with I think 30-some Congress people signing in support, which, you know, that's many ways, I think, for people who know the U.S. Congress, somewhat unprecedented for something that could be somehow deemed as maybe anti-Israel. If all of these things really are actually having a positive effect, hence the scramble to try to tamp it down.
The letter that we got in Congress, it was 32 signatures, plus an additional letter from two other members of Congress, was historic. It was far beyond the number of signatures that have ever been obtained on a letter for Palestinian rights. And I think it's a sign of shifting times and that people are really shifting positions from blind support for Israel, which has been the status quo for far too long, to standing for Palestinian human rights. And this is absolutely a threat to the Israeli regime here. Israel clearly says that the BDS movement is one of the greatest threats against them. And, you know, it's kind of sad that a country would be so threatened by a rights-based approach using entire nonviolence and grounded in the tradition of the civil rights movement in the U.S. and the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa.
And I'm curious, you know, just in your sort of travel, I mean, what are some of the things that you think are the biggest obstacles to making more progress, at least on the American side of this, and getting more balance on this issue? I mean, having had some success in Congress recently, I mean, what are some of the pivot points on pushing the issue forward, do you think?
Well, one of the obstacles that we face is the Israeli lobby. AIPAC shamelessly pushes Congress to provide unquestioned U.S. financial and diplomatic support for Israel. And they basically threaten the re-election campaigns of any member of Congress who doesn't comply. This is an attack on our basic democracy and the way that we function as a government. So that's definitely one of the obstacles. And Congress members fear AIPAC when they put a foot out for Palestinian rights, even to stand with somebody like Issa, who has never been violent at any time in his life, is recognized by the European Union, the United Nations, the U.S. State Department, and on and on and on. Still, that is something that's risky for members of Congress because of the Israel lobby.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's 100% true. I always think of John Conyers, who always gets these challengers when he runs for re-election now. And the only way, the last guy that he had the last election, I'll never forget it, is the guy had one of the most – it was a terrible website. But in all caps, it just said, strong supporter of Israel. And I said, okay, well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out how this guy got in the race, why he seems to think he is viable, and why that would be on his the one thing that was in all caps and 15-point font of his issues page. So point there, very well taken in terms of what's out there. And I should say, you are still there. You are still carrying this. People who are looking to follow what you are doing over there, I assume that you're keeping folks updated on what's happening in Issa's case and everything that's going on out there. How can they follow you better?
So you can follow me on Twitter at Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, Elyse, E-L-Y-S-E, Gold. You can also follow Issa himself on Twitter at ISSAAMRO, Issa Amro. You can find me easily on Facebook, as well as being able to find Issa. And you can also follow Code Pink on Twitter. That's just at Code Pink. And on Facebook as well, and Instagram. And we keep it updated about what's happening.
Yeah, no, well, perfectly. I hope people check that out and look at it. It does sort of also remind me as well. I mean, that's one of the interesting things that we've also been seeing here is the social media and other things like that being monitored by the IDF. I mean, sort of a vast online information gathering sort of chilling effect that they're trying to put in here. It seems as much as sort of an on-the-ground physical presence as well.
Israel is an incredibly repressive state under military laws, which is what Palestinians are subject to in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Gathering in groups of more than 10 people for any political purpose is illegal. And those are many of the charges that Issa has against him, participating in an illegal demonstration, which means more than 10 people, more than 10 Palestinians were together for political purposes. So protest here is entirely illegal. Calling for human rights for Palestinians is often prosecuted as, and this is true in Issa's case, as incitement. It's just absurd how repressive the regime here is. And Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East. I know the last time I looked, I considered freedom of speech and freedom of assembly to be important tenets of democracy.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think as far as they're concerned, it's democracy, but only for a certain subset of people, which isn't democratic at all, it seems.
Well, and even not necessarily even for that subset of people anymore, now that we have this new ban on supporters of the BDS movement. So I would be within that subset of people. I am a Jewish American. I send my children to, I sent them to Hebrew school and to Jewish summer camp. I belong to a synagogue. I am exactly that subset of people. But because I'm critical of the Israeli government, because I choose to stand with Palestinians in their struggle for freedom, I am pushed over into the category of undesirables and viciously attacked. So, you know, that again, attacking the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, whether in Israel or in the U.S., because we have many attacks against the movement in the U.S., infringes on our on freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, I certainly do appreciate that. I appreciate you exercising your rights of free speech. That was Arielle Gold. She gave it to you. You can follow her online. Also follow Issa Amro to find out how this is all playing out in real time. Arielle, thank you so much for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary. That is going to do it for us here today on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.